The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Friends, welcome to the Bill Press Pod, Friday morning, June 11, about 8:30 a.m., and time for this week's Reporters Roundtable. And for the first time in the Biden administration, the spotlight is on foreign policy. The president himself off to repair relations with our G7 allies and NATO before stepping into the lion's den with Vladimir Putin. The vice president in Guatemala and Mexico, with a blunt message to anybody who might be considering a trek to our southern border, don't come. Meanwhile, on the domestic front, a bipartisan group of senators announces a tentative $1 trillion infrastructure deal, but Joe Manchin probably kills the possibility of any deal on voting rights, and Donald Trump reportedly tells supporters, "Don't worry, I'll be back in the Oval Office by the end of August." So much to talk about, so little time, so let's dive right in. With today's panel, Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the LA Times. Hello, Jen.
Hello, Bill.
Good to have you with us. Sudeep Reddy, managing editor of Politico. Hi, Sudeep.
Hey, Bill.
And Hunter Walker, publisher, proprietor, founder of The Uprising, the great new newsletter we all subscribe to. Hello, Hunter.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
Fine. Or if we don't yet subscribe to, we should, right, Hunter? There's the word.
It's at theuprising.info. Thank you, Bill.
There you go. All right. I know there's a lot of attention on what's happening with the foreign trip, but I want to start here at home with the breaking news. Jen, your territory, that last night, the Gang of 10, five Republicans and five Democrats in the Senate, announced a, I don't know, tentative, shall we call it, deal on infrastructure, about $1.2 trillion. Is this for real? Jen, what do you know?
It's a little early to say. It's definitely fair to have a lot of skepticism right now. This is only five Republicans who've signed on to this. And of course, any deal that gets to the Senate's filibuster would need 10 Republicans, and they don't have that right now. When they put this announcement out, they wanted to have those 10 in pocket to show the potential here, and they don't have that. They didn't even release the full plan that they've agreed to. Their statement was just a couple sentences. So this definitely has the potential to turn into a deal that is signed by President Biden. But right now, a lot of skepticism that you can pick up five more Republicans and, importantly, not lose a bunch of Democrats on the other side. And, the taxes are going to continue to remain an issue. There's chatter that a gas tax increase would not fly with Biden because it would violate his pledge not to increase taxes on people making under $400,000. So that's going to be one of the most significant early hurdles.
And Sudeep, it doesn't matter how many moderate Republicans sign on to this deal. Mitch McConnell will decide whether it goes forward or not, won't he?
That's right. Mitch McConnell will determine whether you can even get five more Republicans to sign on to this. And even if you do, whether it's even worth going forward on. There is a possibility that Mitch McConnell will jump on something like this because it's going to be less expensive than other bills. And the idea being that if they can lure Democrats into doing a smaller bill, then they can stop anything else that comes after that. That's obviously not going to work for most Democrats, and that therein lies the problem, that Democrats want something much larger and much more ambitious.
Right. So, Hunter, as both Sudeep and Jen pointed out, not all Democrats are crazy about this, particularly because so far in this deal, it looks like there's none of the climate change stuff that Biden had originally proposed, which people like Ron Wyden say is absolutely necessary. So, Hunter, do you think in the end, after all of this attempts at bipartisanship, they're just going to ram it through with all Democratic votes?
You know, the Biden administration has responded in the past to these kind of more progressive gripes with some of his policy by kind of making the argument, you know, Mitch McConnell's against it. These folks are against it. So we feel like we're in sort of the perfect middle way. And I think that's a strong posture for the president. But at the end of the day, as Sudeep was pointing out, you know, Mitch McConnell on one level very much seems to hold all of the cards. So, you know, with Biden eager to kind of seem like a reasonable compromiser and his power, you know, he can get a smaller bill here. I think the question that's kind of looming over all of this is the progressive push to eliminate the filibuster. And, you know, the thing that Mitch has to calculate is how much can he block before that really becomes untenable and that gets louder and that becomes more of a middle way among Democrats.
Well, you lead us there. Let's jump right in. Because Joe Manchin certainly brought the issue of the filibuster back to the forefront with his op-ed last Sunday when he said he would vote against the Voting Rights Act, for the People Act, and against any change in the filibuster. I will give credit to our producer, Jay Feldman, for pulling this one out of the archives here back on July 5, 1963, to tell you how long we've been dealing with this issue. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
With a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster, they won't let the majority senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people.
So, Jen, did Joe Manchin, in effect, kill any chances of any change to the filibuster?
I think so. I mean, if you listen to Manchin, as I've done for the last 6 months very closely, he has never indicated that he was open to changing the filibuster at all. And I think that's been a really hard lesson for some Democrats to really absorb, because they had so much hope that this was going to be their opportunity to make a lot of change. And now, you know, it's not just Manchin. He's really just representing a handful. We don't know how many, but several Senate Democrats who don't want to change the filibuster. I'd add one caveat to that. One thing that I'm looking at is whether the Supreme Court strikes down the Affordable Care Act. If they did something dramatic there, I think that's one area in which Joe Manchin, who represents West Virginia, where the ACA is extremely popular despite its deep red leanings, I see that as one area where he might be willing to change the filibuster. And other than that, I just don't see it happening. So not only voting rights, but a lot of other things are going to get held up when that filibuster remains in place.
But Sudeep, a little research I did on my own, Joe Manchin, 10 years ago, I know, 10 years ago, he did say, we can't let the filibuster block the Senate from getting anything done. This is the same Joe Manchin. And he said, one example is, it should not be used to stop a bill from getting to the floor for debate. Shouldn't be used as that threshold or gateway to the floor. What happened?
You know, Senator Manchin is willing to support a lot of changes to the filibuster in terms of how it works. But it seems at his core, he still wants to at least create the perception that he is the driver of bipartisanship.
But what changes has he actually supported? I don't know of any.
Terms of how the filibuster is done, the talking filibuster, the allowing senators to basically bypass the hard parts of the filibuster. He wants to make
standing
them work
up,
for it.
Exactly. Standing up and talking. Right.
And he has indicated support for some of those measures. But that doesn't necessarily change like the fundamental issue around needing to get to 60 votes. And he's still got 4 years before he faces voters. But when he does, he'll be able to argue in an overwhelmingly Republican state that he at least has been trying to keep this together. Whether any of that matters, I don't know. It's really hard to see that mattering in the end. Joe Manchin is going to be Joe Manchin.
So Hunter, in a sort of in a sense of saying, but I'm not an entirely bad guy. Joe Manchin in that op-ed said, I'm not going to vote for the For the People Act, but I will vote for the John Lewis Voting Rights Act when that comes up later in the year. And the very next day, Mitch McConnell responded with this message.
There's no threat to the voting rights law. It's against the law to discriminate in voting on the basis of race already. And so I think it's unnecessary.
So we circle back to Mitch McConnell running the show. Hunter?
I mean, one point I think we have to make is that when it comes to the For the People Act, you know, we don't need to go back to Joe Manchin 10 years ago. We just go back to 2019. And before he was for it, before he was against it, he was for it. And in fact, he was a co-sponsor.
Yeah. Co-sponsor, you know? Right.
So there's a lot of gymnastics going on with his positioning here. And another force going on behind the scenes is you have these very dramatic Republican bills, particularly in Florida and in Arizona, mm-hmm. that are kind of chipping away at voting access, if you will. And Mitch McConnell sort of simplifying it by saying it's not, you know, legal to discriminate against, voters by race. But a lot of people would argue that, in effect, some of these restrictive voting laws do that. But I think we were really kind of getting to this fundamental dynamic of gridlock that exists right now in Congress, where through the filibuster, Mitch McConnell holds all the cards. I think Jen was pointing out that all this focus may be on Joe Manchin, but what I hear from the Hill is there are a lot of Democrats who are kind of worried, about moving the filibuster in more moderate states. And he actually takes heat for them, which they extremely appreciate. And the question is going to be things like the ACA. You know, is there a point where Mitch McConnell's blocking something that Joe Manchin and some of these other folks feel creates political risk for them in their home states?
Yeah, I just want to add, I had lunch with a top lobbyist yesterday who told me, oh, there we go, Hunter, your friend joining us. But this top lobbyist who told me that with Joe Manchin, actually, and Jen, you sort of alluded to this, that he doesn't speak for himself. We don't know who the other people are, but he actually represents maybe a half a dozen Democrats, some of whom we might be surprised at, who agree with him in not supporting the For the People Act or not getting rid of the filibuster.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So maybe someday those names will come out. Okay, let's jump overseas with this big foreign tour. I got to tell you, watching yesterday, Joe Biden and Boris Johnson together, I mean, best buds forever, it looked like. And then Jill Biden showing up with her famous blazer. Jen, this looks like the European love tour, right? Starting off, at any rate. What does Biden hope to accomplish, at least in the first phase of this trip?
Well, I think you phrased it exactly right, the love tour. I mean, it was literally emblazoned on Jill Biden's blazer, but if Biden... You know, this is what Biden kind of ran on, is having great relationships with foreign leaders. And he's going to have this love fest with other Western European leaders, show that America has changed since the Trump years. And he wants to send that message to Europe that America's back and that America wants to be a team player. You know, we have the COVID vaccines that the U.S. is contributing half of the supply for to the rest of the world. So, Love Fest seems like a perfect way to frame the first part of this trip. Obviously, that will change as the trip moves on.
Right. And Sudeep, here is the president yesterday when he arrived. I think this was talking to the members of the military after he first got there, talking about how important these relationships really are.
America is better positioned to advance our national security and our economic prosperity when we bring together like-minded nations to stand with us. These nations that have shed blood alongside of us in defense of our shared values. Our unrivaled network of alliances and partnerships that are the key to American advantage in the world and have been.
And Sudeep, the world leaders or the European leaders that I've seen quoted, they're kind of happy, right? They see this as a sigh of relief.
Oh yeah, they're loving the 180 from America these days. They're seeing it in dealings with the EU, where President Trump was openly hostile to the idea of multilateralism. They're seeing it with NATO in the few days. We'll see it. You'll certainly see it when Biden moves on to meet with Putin. It's just going to be a completely different tone and tenor to these conversations. But there's still a layer of skepticism underneath of, okay, well, this is good for right now. But a lot of Europeans are wondering, well, like, what if the old ways come back? I don't think any of them think Trump is going to be back in August, but they do wonder what he's leaving behind in terms of his forces and what they mean for who comes next after Biden.
Yeah, which means, Hunter, it's rebuilding the trust is not going to happen overnight, right? I mean, they are worried that we flipped so far in one direction the last time that we could do it again.
And let's be honest. I mean, we don't right now. I was about to say we don't look like the most stable nation. I don't think we are the most stable nation. We are, you know, 5 months out from, you know, an attack on the halls of Congress where people were, you know, storming through the halls in an effort to overturn the election. And you know, I think there's a little bit of a collective amnesia about that. But that sort of violent attempt at autocracy is what we normally associate with, I think, more, you know, as they say, underdeveloped nations. And that's where we are right now. So, you know, I think the world would be right to, you know, wonder about our stability. Joe Biden is doing everything he can on every front, whether it's, you know, optics or words, to protect a sense of calm and normalcy. But, you know, the world's going to need to see, you know, a lot more than 5 months to understand that America is stable and back to a similar posture to where we were before.
So Sudeep, let me jump with you to next week, or the end of, I guess, beginning of next week, when Biden sits down with Vladimir Putin in Geneva. I guess at least we know this, right? It's not going to be the same message that Donald Trump took to his meeting with Vladimir Putin.
it will not be. We still don't know what those messages were that happened in their one-on-ones. This is going to be Joe Biden's attempt to show that he's tough on Russia, that he actually means it when it comes to blocking Russia and Russians from hacking, from the ransomware attacks that are going on, from all sorts of other moves with Ukraine. All of these are steps that Biden has to find a way to get across. And what comes later will actually be the test. If Putin keeps doing what he's doing, then it's a question for how Biden might react to that and how he might actually show America's strength in these in this domain.
Hunter, what do you think he wants to come away from his meeting with Putin? But what Biden wants to come away with after his meeting from Putin?
Well, I think one of the most important gains for him would be what Sudeep was pointing towards earlier, which is just, you know, a visibly different posture and relationship, you know, to what President Trump had. You know, one thing that was so interesting during the Trump years was a lot of people would point at the sanctions and say, you know, look, we're being very tough behind the scenes. And then Trump would, you know, have those tweets and other rhetoric that would, you know, raise real questions about his relationship with Putin. So I think Biden wants to put his foot down on that front. But, you know, one thing I've always wondered is, you know, substantively, we're fighting this asymmetrical game with Russia where they, you know, are very interested in this kind of unconventional information warfare and hacking warfare. And our response is it's hard not to see them as slaps on the wrist. I mean, Putin and his inner circle are still tremendously wealthy. He still has, you know, tremendous control over that country. And as Sudeep was pointing out, we're seeing SolarWinds, which is maybe the worst hack ever, even though it didn't target our elections. We're seeing this ransomware stuff. It's not really stopping. And I'm not 1,000% sure, you know, how much Biden can do about that.
Right. So, Jen, the president's trip follows the first foreign trip for the vice president, Kamala Harris, which was all carefully planned out, including an interview one-on-one with Lester Holt of NBC's Everything NBC. Everything seemed to be going swimmingly until this little exchange. We can't avoid it. Here it is.
Okay. Do you have any plans to visit the border?
I'm here in Guatemala today. We are going to the border. We've been to the border. So this whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm in Guatemala because my focus is dealing with the root causes of migration.
Jen, you and I know, as Californians, she's been to the border. She was there as a Attorney General of California. She was there as a United States Senator from California. Why wasn't she ready for that question?
Yeah, it was really puzzling. We all know that she's kind of struggled with media interviews, and this is not one of her strong suits. But it was really a horrible, unforced error. And it undermines the idea that you have to, you know, these politicians go to these countries. The whole reason she went to Guatemala was to send the message of how important the root cause of my immigration is, as she was saying. Biden is going to Europe to make a send a message to our allies. And so if you're saying you don't need to go to these places to make a point, it's a very odd message. And you know, clearly the administration is trying to shift this idea that she was in charge of the border crisis away. And, Republicans are just seizing that moment. And I think this is going to follow her for a long time. And it's a really puzzling, unforced error.
Again, it seems to me she had a quick answer, an easy answer, but she just didn't give, and then it became a very painful interview. Sudeep, overall, the message that she gave in Guatemala was to anybody who's thinking of coming to the United States, don't come. That's basically the same message Donald Trump was sending.
Yes, and it is technically the position of the administration to say don't come, but to provide it in soundbite fashion like that was really just remarkable. Look, the vice president has perhaps one of the hardest portfolios that she's been handed by President Biden, dealing with immigration, dealing with voting rights, a lot of intractable issues. This was not going to be a winner for her going down there, and there had to be some better prep work and messaging than what we saw coming out of it. But it does raise some questions about how she does in these kinds of settings, where even on a slightly controversial question, she kind of just bombed it, and she's going to have to figure out a way to recover from that.
What do you think, Hunter? Are we making too much of this? Is the media in general making too much of this? A hiccup at this interview?
You know, I got slammed the other day on Twitter because I dared to say that, you know, the vice president's tweet heading into Memorial Day weekend, where she sort of, it was kind of bizarre. They tweeted from her official account just a picture of her and said, enjoy the long weekend. And you know, a lot of people, you know, immediately piled onto that and said, like, why is she not commemorating the troops? Now, look, I don't think that tweet was the worst thing in the world, but at the same time, I think that criticism was very, very predictable. And I think, fair or not, there is sort of a you know, very rote right-wing outrage cycle that, you know, a smart Democratic politician would be mindful of. And it's not nothing, because it affects your ability and your stature to get things done. And it affects positioning, you know, with some perhaps more moderate independent voters. So I think this focus on going to the border versus the root causes is a little silly. I don't think, you know, Ted Cruz is able to accomplish much on the policy level by, you know, putting on a camo hat and posing dramatically by a fence. But I think that they know some people want that. And that answer of I've already been there is so much better than what we saw her give in that interview.
Right, exactly. Okay, Jen Habercorn and Sudeep Reddy, Hunter Walker, our panelists today, today's roundtable. Still lots more to talk about here, so let's take a quick break and then we'll pick up on the other side here on the Bill Press Pod. And today's roundtable brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers, the good men and women of the AFT, under the leadership of President Randy Weingarten. Boy, they have been on the front lines now. For sure, they always are, but particularly for the last 18 months, handling the challenge brought to us by the pandemic of first organizing classes at home and then organizing for the hybrid classes, a little at home, a little in school, and now overseeing the return to the classroom, if not now, at least entirely by the fall. We salute the teachers of America, the good members of the AFT, 1.7 million members strong, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Today's roundtable, taking a look back at the news of the week with Hunter Walker, publisher of The Uprising, Sudeep Reddy, managing editor for Politico, and Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the LA Times. A pretty shocking report late yesterday from the New York Times that the Department of Justice under Donald Trump, we had heard earlier, that as part of their leak investigation, Jeff Sessions was prying into the emails and of reporters from CNN and from the New York Times. Now we learn that they were also prying into the Apple accounts of at least two Democratic members of Congress, Adam Schiff, who was the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, and Eric Swalwell, who was a member of the Intelligence Committee. Sudeep, what the hell, right? I mean, this is spying on American citizens.
It's remarkable to see the continuation on so many fronts, on seizing journalists' phone records, on spying on these folks here. It's perplexing that we're 4 months into this administration and we still have these bits of information coming out. And it's perplexing. That's the one piece of it. And I think the White House is starting to realize it's got to get a handle on what's going on at the Justice Department and on so many fronts to be able to explain what happened before and what's happening now.
Jen, I don't know whether anybody from the LA Times had been a subject of this Department of Justice inquiry, but it certainly has a chilling effect on reporters who are covering the Pentagon or the Congress.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know of any LA Times reporters who were caught up in it, but it definitely has an impact on how you talk to sources, and it's definitely scary to see. It's scary to see that, you know, they're going after reporters and members of Congress now.
Apparently, Hunter, according to the Times, the subjects of these investigations were identified by Donald Trump, who basically considered Schiff and Swalwell for certainly as the enemy. And he directs weaponizing, basically, the DOJ to go after people he considered his political enemies. Very Nixonian, huh?
Yeah, and there, you know, are a lot of instances of these sort of investigations or government moves that were kind of driven by his, you know, conspiratorial mindset. I'm thinking of, you know, Mark Meadows pursuing, you know, bizarre election theories and trying to get the acting attorney general to go in that direction. And I think this ties back to what we were talking about before. I mean, we are just coming out of this period where these really, really shocking things happened. And you know, I think there's going to be a lot more revelations in the coming months and years about, you know, just how close we came to some pretty dark stuff, and also how many things did actually take place that, you know, would have been unthinkable a long time ago.
Right. So it was tomorrow will be a week from Donald Trump's first reappearance on the campaign trail, speaking at a big Republican dinner down in North Carolina. Everybody was waiting to see what new message the former president might bring to the political scene. And it turns out it wasn't so much a new message at all, but sort of some, if I could call it, recycled bullshit. Here is the president last Saturday.
That election will go down as the crime of the century, and our country is being destroyed by people who perhaps have no right to destroy it.
People who have no right to destroy it. Anybody want to try to make any sense of this, Sudeep?
Oh boy, this is, you know, I think this is going to become a version of the in 2 weeks phenomenon of Donald Trump, that he's always trying to get attention and stay in the news cycle. And so he's going to repeat all of his lines and bring them up. And then he's going to also keep raising the idea that he's going to return to office. Like, I think we were expecting the in one QAnon theory that he'd be back in office by March. Now, after these mysterious Arizona results, like, come back with the truth, we'll be back in August. and it's just it's bizarre, but it is fittingly bizarre for the times that we're in to see this just like this. Snowball. And the thing that we have to be watchful of and wary of is that the president has tens of millions of supporters who believe him on this stuff. And he runs the risk of radicalizing even more people than what we saw on January 6th. And we just don't know what that's going to turn out to be.
Well, Jen, the craziest theory that I saw this week was that the president on a talk radio show toying with the idea that he might run for Congress in this newly created congressional seat in Florida and then run for speaker. I mean,
it's certainly possible. You don't even have to be a member of Congress technically to be elected Speaker of the House. So if, I never thought of this scenario, but if Republicans take control of the House, they certainly could elect Donald Trump as Speaker. That's a scenario.
Well, some people point out, though, he is no John Quincy Adams. I mean, the idea that
right.
Donald Trump would be comfortable as a lowly member of the House, even as speaker.
Hardly, yeah, exactly. Right? I mean, the thing that's most remarkable to me is, I mean, Donald Trump has defied a lot of norms, but, you know, further defying the norm of, you know, presidents, once they leave office, you know, kind of fading into the night and doing charity work, but not really getting involved in partisan politics. And, former President Trump is certainly defying that norm in a way that is going to cause a lot of consternation for Republicans in Congress for a very, very long time.
Hunter, what do the Republicans do that they say they want to focus on the future with a former president who will not leave the scene, who only wants to focus on the past? They're stuck, aren't they?
And a former president who remains extremely popular with the base.
Yeah,
who,
and pointed out,
you know, is, and I think it's important to get into his motivations, right? Is he doing this because, you know, he wants to potentially make money and stay relevant? Is he doing this because, with multiple investigations into him, remaining a political actor allows him to frame them as a witch hunt? Or is he sincerely trying to come back, undemocratically or not? I don't purport to know the answer, but he's very much still on stage, and he very much still has a hold on a big portion of the party. So I think so far what we've seen is, you know, leaders of the more mainline Republican organizations literally, you know, running down to Mar-a-Lago to pay tribute and hand him made-up awards. We've seen them going down there for fundraisers because that still is the heart of the party. So, yeah, I don't think at this moment we're seeing the Republican Party move away from Trump. And unless the poll numbers and dynamics start to shift a ton, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we get, you know, a Justin Amash or Jeb-like figure who sort of tries to have a never Trump, you know, primary bid. Mm-hmm. But right now the dynamics are very close to him. At the same time, you know, he's an old man. And I think even if a Trump ally sort of becomes the next standard bearer, there is a clock on how long he can be the prime figure in the party.
Right. Well, I just can't resist this because for once, Donald Trump did not say the craziest thing of any political figure this week. I think that award has to go to, not for the first time, Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas, who in a congressional hearing where they were talking about what might be done about climate change, Louie Gohmert came up with a certainly an original and unique idea. Here he is.
Is there anything that the National Forest Service or BLM can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Obviously, that would have profound effects on our climate.
I would have to follow up with you on that one, Mr. Gohmert.
Yeah.
That's the poor woman from the Forest Service who really, you heard the long pause. She didn't know what the hell to say. Sudeep, does it get any crazier than that?
I think with Louie Gohmert, you can count on something even more creative coming down the road on this front. Look, I guess that maybe shows a commitment to climate change that didn't exist before to dealing with it. This seems like a little more extreme than switching to an electric car or cutting back your meat consumption. But maybe there's a silver lining here.
So, Jennifer, it was just a couple of weeks ago that Louie Gohmert, on a speech on the floor, said he realizes that some people think he's the dumbest man in Congress. Did he just prove it?
Oh, maybe so. You know, I watch a lot of congressional hearings, and it is pretty amazing some of the things that you hear members of Congress ask. But this takes the cake in my reporting career, I believe.
The poor woman from the Forest Service, she didn't know what the hell to say in response to that. All right, Hunter, I want to give you the last word before we get to your favorite stories of the week, folks. But Hunter, in the uprising, you've been paying a lot of attention to the New York mayor's race, which is such a wild scene. We're less than 2 weeks, I think, from the primary now, right? Early voting starts this week or very soon?
Early voting is beginning. The primary is on June 22nd.
There you go.
Give us your
capsule summary of where the things stand right now.
So this is the first race where they have this new ranked choice voting system. The polls have been all over the map. You know, to the point that Maya Wiley was in fourth in one poll on Monday. By Wednesday, another poll had her up on two in second place. So I think we're all sort of flying blind with this one. But one thing that's consistent is Eric Adams and Andrew Yang do seem to be near the front of the pack. And, you know, one thing to point out for readers, this Democratic primary is likely decisive given how many Democratic voters there are in New York. So Eric Adams is an interesting figure. He had this whole, you know, controversy this week over whether he actually lives in the city. And he took reporters into this house where he said he lives in Brooklyn. It had a bed in the middle of the room. People were wondering if it's really his son's house. He certainly, by his own admission, you know, sleeps a lot of nights in his government office where he set up a bed and all this stuff for his plant-based diet. So it's been a wild race filled with uniquely New York political scandals. And, you know, in the home stretch, it seems to be Eric Adams in front. He's more of a moderate. And then Maya Wiley, the civil rights lawyer and former official in the de Blasio administration, she's gotten late support from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think the weekend before last, last week, she got Elizabeth Warren. It's hard to look at these polls, but she does seem to be gaining momentum. So I think she has ingredients for a late surge. But the bottom line is it's totally up in the air with just less than 2 weeks to go.
And you can follow it all in The Uprising, theuprising.com, as well as in the New York Times and the rest of the media.
Okay. Theuprising.info. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Info.
I couldn't
Thank
get
you.
The .com, Bill. I couldn't do it.
Oh, all right. Sorry about that. I'm trying to remember that. Here we go. You know, we always say there's one story, despite everything we're covering, as much as we're racing from story to story, there's one story that makes you stop in your tracks and say, oh, my God. Either for good or for bad, our favorite story of the week. Where are we? Jennifer, let's start with you.
I'm going to go with the very obvious story in ProPublica, the secret IRS files, trove of never-before-seen records reveal how the wealthiest avoid income tax.
Yeah.
I mean, this story just, you know, resonated so deeply, and I think it's going to have a lot of impact on tax policy from Democrats in future years, showing that, you know, the country's richest folks paid little to no income tax. And really remarkable reporting on behalf of ProPublica, and it's really going to resonate.
Yeah, and also referencing what we talked about earlier with this DOJ investigation, right, of reporters and members of Congress, the fact that this stuff, ProPublica was able to get into the IRS, right, and get these records
Absolutely.
And make them public is another whole issue as well. Scary on several fronts, indeed. Sudeep, what caught your attention?
You know, I'm gonna go with one of my favorite stories of the week because it was just so absurdly fun. Representative Mo Brooks, a Republican from Alabama, he was served papers in a lawsuit by Eric Swalwell on the Capitol riot. He went on Twitter to protest how it was done, how the papers were served. And to prove his point, he took a picture of his monitor showing a page from Alabama law. And instead of taking a proper screenshot with his computer, he took a picture and tweeted it out. And right at the bottom of that screen, that screen are passwords for what appear to be his family's accounts online, Momar5456, an email address, a PIN. It was just too perfect. And the best part of this, of course, is that Representative Mo Brooks sits on a House Cybersecurity Subcommittee.
Oh,
so who needs Russia when you've got people inflicting this on themselves? Just go figure.
I think he's giving Louis Gohmert a run for his money. Okay, Hunter, wrap it up here.
But, you know, when I wasn't going on shopping sprees with Mo Brooks' credit card information this week, I was reading the news. And there's a really great story in New York Magazine by Erin Carmone, who's just one of my favorite writers generally and really without peer in, I think, the legal space. And she has this long look at Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, this Yale Law School power couple. The world might remember Amy from her Tiger Mom book. But they've been incredibly influential, including, you know, being seen as a pipeline to Supreme Court clerkships. And yet they're just going through so much personal and professional scandal at Yale, you know, with allegations of sexual harassment and parties where they're drinking too much with students.
Dinner parties with students. Yep. All that.
Yeah. Drunken dinner parties with students. And it's just a really interesting read and a fascinating glimpse into, you know, the world of high powered law schools and the Supreme Court pipeline, which is, I think, something that has so much influence over all of our lives. But, you know, prior to reading this, I didn't really understand much about it and certainly didn't know how chaotic and messy it all was.
Okay, so for my favorite story, I credit Politico for providing my favorite story of the week. Yesterday, Politico reporter Natalie Fertig intercepted Senator Bernie Sanders and wanted to ask him a couple of questions, and she identified herself as Politico's cannabis reporter. Here is her exchange with an unbelieving Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Natalie Fertig with Politico. I'm the cannabis reporter. There's been
You are the cannabis
reporter.
Are you stoned now?
I'm not stoned right now, but I will ask you a question.
Is that a requirement to be?
It's actually not.
Okay, just wanted to check it out.
I know. It's a good question.
He wants the goods.
So Bernie wants to know if she is stoned at the moment. I think we buried the lead here. Politico has a cannabis supporter, Sadiq.
We actually have a three-person cannabis team. It's a big business with a lot of policy across the country. I think Bernie Sanders is going to have to become a subscriber now.
So Hunter, does the Uprising have a cannabis supporter?
I mean, I'm as I said to you, the head cook and bottle washer over there. But you know, I'm working on a book about Bernie, and one of the things that's super funny about him is that you know Burlington is one of the most you know pot friendly cities in the country, right? And he's moved in all these spaces, including like activist spaces in the '60s and '70s, where you know there's no question there was a lot of this around. But Bernie is totally as straight as it gets, and I think. That moment was just like a really interesting one where you see both like his total awareness of this stuff. I mean, I think for a lot of people on the Hill that the words cannabis reporter would just fly over their head. But also like he's totally not he's not partaking himself. You know, he's he's deeply skeptical of it while being very fully aware.
But Jen, some people may not realize I do because I know several members of this. There is a cannabis caucus in the House of Representatives of members who support legalization of pot. So
absolutely. I will say there's a caucus for just about everything on Capitol Hill. There's two caucuses related to growing flowers, wine caucuses, bicycle caucuses. The joke is that you can find a caucus for just about anything, but I would suspect that this one is relatively active just because there is, you know, such a substantial legal fight between the states and the feds on this issue. So this might be one of the more active caucuses.
Right.
Well, if I may, you know, there's also a cannabis lobby. This is a $1 billion industry. And I hate to end us on a bit of a downer note, but I saw this tweet the other day. I don't want to be a buzzkill as we're sitting here talking about pot, but it was a tweet with this incredible video of this like giant robotic machine that was churning out the pre-rolled joints that they sell in some of these legalized cannabis venues. And some girl had captured it and she, you know, had quote tweeted it. And she said, you know, my tío, my uncle in Spanish, did 3 years in jail for selling pot. And now people are making millions. I hate to be a downer, but as we talk about how legitimate this is getting on the Hill, it's worth noting, I think, that there are a lot of people who are not part of the $1 billion legitimized thing and actually have like suffered a lot for trying to be in this business or you know, consuming these products.
Well, congratulations, Sadiq. Politico is ahead of the game here with a three-person cannabis team.
We might call it a cipher.
Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, latimes.com. Sadiq Reddy, managing editor of Politico, politico.com. And Hunter Walker, publisher of the uprising.info, correct?
Yes, the uprising.info. Please subscribe, folks.
Okay, and thank you, guys. Thanks for being with us today. Great job, and thank you all for listening and joining us on today's roundtable. We'll see you next week, early next week, with a special interview with Brian Stelter from CNN, host of The Reliable Sources. Brian talking to us about how Fox News and other right-wing media are navigating the political landscape in this post-Trump era, or maybe we should say new version of Trump era. That's next on the Bill Press Pod. Meanwhile, take care of yourself, stay safe, stay strong, stay happy, and come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.